by the first interviews that we had, and some of them are just other questions that had occurred to me, and some Dr. Edge himself had suggested that I ask you. So I think we'll just run through, and now there may be some here. Were there any that you would prefer not to talk about?
No, except that some I have better information on.
That's quite all right.
Like the first one, what was the first course related to religious education that was taught at Southern Seminary?
Mm-hmm.
According to my experience, the first regular credit course was taught by Dr. Byron DeMent. Is that name familiar?
Yes.
Dr. DeMent was Dr. Mullins' associate. He met Dr. Mullins' class in theology, systematic theology, when Dr. Mullins had to be away. And he took on this course. Then he was elected president of the New Orleans Seminary, left the vacancy, and level one. The elder level boy.
Landrum level.
Commuted from Nashville here in a one semester course, I think.
Right. Interesting thing about Dr. DeMent that I learned was that he taught at Southwestern Seminary when he was a part of Baylor University, mm-hmm. when it first started.
Mm-hmm.
Then he came here, and then he went to New Orleans, mm-hmm. and was one of the few that taught at all three seminaries.
Yes,
Very interesting.
Yes.
He
wasn't the world's best teacher, but he was quite zealous and earnest. His substituting for Dr. Mullins was quite painful.
Did you know Dr. DeMent?
Oh, yes, I studied with him.
Right. Didn't he die in about 1926 or 27, somewhere around in there? Or maybe it was in the early 30s?
I'm not sure. I think it was the early 30s.
Right. And I've read some about him, I don't really know a great deal about him.
He had the mastery of the Bible. He could quote almost any reference that you would call him for.
Hmm.
No, that opened the way for me to come. Landrum Level then had a stroke and was incapacitated. Dr. Mullins had an appointment with Dr. Van Ness, Secretary of the Sun School Board, to inquire if he could have him find someone to take Level's place on a full-time basis. And they drafted me.
See, you know, I was looking in some old catalogs, and I saw in the catalog Dr. Gardner was listed as having done some teaching in the area of Sunday school pedagogy during the time that Dr. Level was teaching. Do you know anything about that? Because
no,
I've not really been
don't.
Able to find any information about it. Of course, he was already on the faculty.
Oh, yes. He taught sociology and preaching. Preaching was his primary work.
Right. And then, of course, after you came, he didn't teach anymore in the area of Sunday school pedagogy or anything like that. But I've not really been able to find any further information about what Dr. Gardner's role was.
He taught preaching, homiletics. And I think that he subbed there for a little while with an emphasis on the relation of preaching and teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't any idea what his course was, what he offered.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my understanding, that he just took over for a little while to fill in until the place could be filled.
Now, I understand that when Dr. Dement came in 1906, they established the department, or at that time I think they called it a school. The school that was like a department of Sunday school pedagogy and a chair of Sunday school pedagogy.
Indeed, it was a school. It was just a course.
Right.
Just a study.
Right. And that continued until 1914 or 15 when Dr. Level came.
That's right.
And Dr. Level was teaching one course per year, I think it was, and came up from Nashville.
Yes, yes, yes.
And he maintained his relationship with the Sunday School Board. Wasn't he in the training union
BYPU,
department, BYPU,
that
at that time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, that was his major responsibility.
Right. And then after you came, that led up to the point at which you came. Do you know of any factors outside of the seminary that sort of influenced this development of the course?
I think Dr. I.J. Van Ness was interested. He was chief editor, and then Dr. Prump's death, he became general secretary. Then, about that time that I came on the staff of the Sunday School Board. Dr. Frost was still living. Dr. Van Ness asked me to come and interview him, let him interview me. We went to see Dr. Frost, who was on his deathbed. He looked me over, read some things that Dr. Van Ness had found out about me. Turned to me and said, "Young man, I hope you could come. Van Ness needs you. A great door and effectual will be opened." And he had a fit of coughing. He had TB. The nurse motioned for us to leave. As we left, Van Ness said, "Well, that settles it. If he wants you and I want you, then I think the Lord must be in it." And I'll just say that he had written a number of letters about it, and every time he would turn to those letters, my name would turn up. And he didn't know whether that was in the providence or not, but then he began to inquire about me and found that I had this background in newspaper work, printer, and decided that he would give me a call. And so I came. I was very happy in my work there. That was my line of previous training. I'd been from the boy in the printing office, and I'd had my union printer's card, and had then been reporter and editor, and had gone to the seminary, had my doctor's degree with a major in church history. My thesis was on Southern Baptist journalism. You may have found something of that in Ryan's thesis.
Yes.
So the Sunday School Board wanted to continue this connection between the board and the seminary. Southwestern was getting started, but had only begun. And this was, of course, the major seminary. Dr. Frost, Dr. Van Ness, Level before his death, he died from the stroke long after he had it, wanted to see the two institutions tied more closely together. What do you ask me here about other the factors?
Well, this is one of the things that Dr. Edge had suggested, that perhaps there were some, at the time that this was developing, there may have been some opposition to religious education as a part of the seminary course.
I didn't feel that.
You're not aware of any?
No, no. That did develop opposition to becoming a school.
Yes, right.
No question about that. I suffered from that.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, Dr. Dobbins, is from 1902 on for 5 or 6 or 7 years, there were a series of Sunday school lectures, and I'm sort of tracing all the way back to 1902. And these were proposed and funded by the Sunday School Board here at the seminary, and gave rise, I think, to even greater interest in Sunday school pedagogy becoming a part of the curriculum. Do you know anything at all about those lectures?
I've never seen any discussion of them, any titles of the lectures, or who gave them.
The first lecture was given by W.K. Hatcher, who was the chairman of the trustees that called Dr. Mullins here.
Yes.
And I thought that was interesting. Well, let me...
There were three men, I think, who were largely contributory to bringing this into the faculty. One was Dr. Sampe, John R. Sampe, who for some 40 years was chairman of the Uniform Lessons Committee.
Yes.
He succeeded Dr. Broadus. Dr. Broadus was the first chairman of this Lessons Committee back when the Uniform Lessons System was adopted.
Oh, really?
He served for a number of years. Dr. Sampe then succeeded him on the faculty, and I think was appointed somewhat because of the tremendous record that Broadus had in this matter. Broadus was a great believer in the Sunday School. Dr. Sampe then became chairman of the Committee on Lessons, the Uniform Lesson Selections. Dr. Sampe told me one time that when his life was summed up, he thought that his greatest contribution worldwide was to this committee.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Then Dr. Mullins had a great part in it. Dr. Mullins came following the so-called Whitsitt controversy. He was our great conciliator, and he too had been writing for the lesson committee, and had been on the committee, and had served the association. Back in those days, the International Sunday School Association was a strong organization. It engendered a great deal of enthusiasm in its annual meetings. The introduction of the Uniform Lesson System gave great impetus of the Sunday School movement. Before that, Dr. Sampe refers to it as the Babel period, when each church or Sunday School chose its own lessons. And then there were some lesson writers. They chose lesson systems. B.F. Jacobs, a layman from Chicago, was one of the leaders in this movement for the Uniform Lesson System. Dr. Broadus was made chairman of the Lesson Selection Committee. And then Dr. Sampe succeeded him, and I think for some 42 years served as chairman of that committee. These two men, plus Dr. Van Ness, who then became secretary, a graduate of this school, a great admirer of the school, and the three of them collaborated in this selection of lessons. There was a movement at one time to introduce other than biblical materials into the Sunday School course. I recall when some man with more liberal ideas than others made quite a strong speech in favor of having something besides the Bible. So many things that could be brought in: history, geography, nature, and so on, poetry, literature. We were shortchanging our Sunday School constituency by having nothing but the Bible. Well, when Dr. Sampe got through with him, there wasn't anything left but shreds. You didn't know Dr. Sampe, of course.
No, but my father did.
Yes.
I heard many things about Dr. Sampe.
Yes.
I've listened to some of his records.
Yeah.
And get a little flavor of the man from that.
He was an unreconstructed Southern rebel. I heard him say on one occasion that he was 21 years old before he knew that damn Yankee was two words. So that fixed it. They've never had any effort since then to have anything but biblical materials. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Sandby put in hours upon hours working out these lesson schemes. The understanding was that the committee would select the biblical materials on a 7-year cycle. I think now it's 5 years. And would choose the unit of Bible materials, and then work out subject, rolling text, and the focal scriptures. And that was to take a student in the Sunday school through the Bible in 7 years. Had something from every part of the Bible in 7 years. Dr. Sampi was strong on what he called a balanced diet. Balancing Old Testament, New Testament, New Testament, Old Testament. He worked out a scheme of reading the Bible through by taking a chapter of Genesis and a chapter of Matthew, second chapter of Genesis, the second chapter of Matthew.
Keeping balance.
A balanced diet, he called it. So the seminary, I never heard of any opposition here to the lectures, not to course of study, now to leadership.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you some questions about the Basil Manley Chair.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding that by 1927 it was fully funded, and that it was funded from the Southern Baptist Sunday Schools collections taken up.
My understanding is that the Sunday School Board put some money into it.
Yes, they did, and the final, well, these were contributions from churches,
yes.
Plus what the Sunday School Board did, actually. Was there ever a time when you first came here from 1920 up to about 27 when it was fully funded, that they sent you out trying to drum up funds for it or anything? I just wondered. The Western Recorder, I was reading about it in the Western Recorder when it was first started, and they said in there that it was the first chair of its kind in any theological seminary. Do you know whether that was true?
To my knowledge, yes.
Mm-hmm. True. Now, over the years, the name of the chair had several different designations. One, for instance, one place I saw it was called the Basil Manley Chair of Church Administration. Other places it was called the Basil Manley Chair of Sunday School Pedagogy.
That's right.
And that was the correct name of it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There was a course offered in the regular theological setup in, what did they call it? Dr. Eager taught it. How did he phrase it? Pastoral theology.
Mm-hmm.
Pastoral theology. That was entirely separate from religious education, mm-hmm. from Sunday School pedagogy.
Right. Now, when you first came here, they had the Department of Sunday School Pedagogy, and then they expanded this to the
department, which is a course of study,
a two-hour course of study. And then they also added the Department of Church Efficiency.
Mm-hmm. That
these two then became the work in religious education?
No, they continued to be separate. They were just two separate courses.
And you were teaching in both areas?
Teaching
I see.
That was one of Dr. Mullen's pet ideas.
Uh-huh.
He had to be a very practically minded man, a statesman. He had been a pastor and had realized that he had gone into the pastorate with very little pastoral background of teaching or experience. He then went to pastorate in Newton Center, I think. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Newton Center. And was called to this place for many reasons. One was that he was a brilliant scholar, majoring in theology. And the other was his acumen to work with people, to understand people, to work with the churches. He was a conciliator. And the seminary had a hard blow with this Richard thing. Almost incredible that it should have been, but it was. So he came and began to cultivate the churches. Something had not been done before. He visited the churches, spoke at conventions, associations, and he discovered that this Sunday school movement was now dominant in many of our churches, many of the associations. It was one of the leading emphases of the churches. And the pastors who'd gone out from this seminary were struggling with trying to give some leadership to it and having had no background in the seminary except Bible. And that was largely his idea. They need somebody to teach this course in what was called pastoral theology. And it was pretty much a pain in the neck. I had it. We spent an entire quarter. Back in those days we had the quarter system on parliamentary law.
How to run a business meeting.
How to be president of a convention or presiding officer of a church meeting. Robert's Rules of Order.
Now, what did you deal with in the area of church efficiency in your courses? What was
well, I had almost no literature. I'd had business experience, and I began to look for materials, the book material, texts, in courses on business administration. The book that appealed to me was Harrington Emerson's 7 Laws of Efficiency. And that was the rising tide in business circles, efficiency. The efficient businessman, the efficient lawyer, the efficient doctor, and so on. And this book fitted pretty well into my need. And there are a few other books with references, but almost nothing dealing directly with administering the affairs of a church. So I struggled through the first year or two, wanting to quit and go back to the Sunday school board, and Dr. Mullen wouldn't let me. I went to him and said, this is not my cup of tea. Let me go back to where I belong. No, he said, we got you started. Anybody else would have the same problem you have. So you must stay home. And he was a pretty firm dictator. They called him the Pope. Not to his face, of course. He was a buzzsaw when it came to handling criticism. Anyhow, I began working on these principles of efficient management. I'd had some contact there with Vanderbilt and Peabody Teachers College. And after the first year, I went back to Nashville, and there began to examine how a university and a teacher's college got students ready for the job. That, to me, was a sensible approach to it. I still had my job back in the Sunday School Board. Van Ness said, now you go, and if you get to any point where you don't want to stay, you, your office will be open. I'm not willing to let anybody move your desk. So I went back and spent the summer, we had a 4-month summer period, investigating how men are trained for vocations. And my assumption was that the minister has a vocation. Preaching is involved, but not only preaching, but he's the pastor of a church, he's the administrator, he's the episcopos. And I hit on the slogan, and I got it from Vanderbilt or Peabody, Ohio, that the business, the function of a vocational school is to prepare the student to do better what he's going to have to do anyhow. Then came the question, what does a pastor have to do anyhow? What we take for granted is that he has to preach. But we'd reached the point where pulpiteers were not in as much demand as they had been. And men who did nothing but pulpit work didn't last long. I had some studies made by our statistics department at Nashville about the length of pastorate. 1925, 18 months was the average. And a man was supposed to be called to preach, and he's called by the church to preach. And he preached himself out the first 18 months. Then I began to work on it, and my first book was The Efficient Church. I'm not particularly proud of it, but then it came out of this experience. They used to kid me about my mimeographing. Well, I had to run anything on this subject of seminary level. We had these little study course books, that's all we had. So I took Harrington's book on efficiency, the concept of efficiency, and the laws of efficiency. It was a standard book in business colleges, and tried to work out something that would be on the level of a seminary textbook, and it lasted pretty well. Dr. Mullins wanted it to be called Church Efficiency. That was his name for it. I wasn't satisfied with Sunday School pedagogy. It was too limited. And besides, pedagogy, by its etymology, means the training of education of children, finals. So I succeeded in getting to change it to religious education.
The teaching of church efficiency was basically two pastors and how to run their church efficiently.
Church management.
And the church interesting thing to me has always been that this area of church efficiency actually went into the school of religious education, whereas it was primarily to train the pastor how to do it. Why did that happen?
Because they had only one man to do this teaching, and I was that one man.
I see.
There was no philosophy back of it.
I see.
And my major became religious education because of the manly chair.
Right. I see.
And the other continued to be a required basic course in the regular seminary curriculum.
Well, I'd always wondered about that because, in particular, like in the 50s, when the school became a school, it was a question to me as to why that course didn't go back into the theology school and then other courses in the religious education school.
As far as I know, for only one reason. I was the teacher of both.
I see. Very interesting. That's an interesting way to set it up. I think I need to turn my tape over. Let me.